Okay, I think that'll work. Good morning, everyone. You'll have to bear with me. I'm going to pull a little bit of a Palin this morning. And I don't mean going on a lavish shopping spree, although.
I may wink.
I may wink at you a few times. But mostly I mean that I'm going to. I'm not going to answer the question on the table exactly. I'm going to talk about what I want to talk about. So, and what I'm going to talk about is not so much healthcare, but actually our approach to health more broadly. And about a year and a half ago, actually now it's almost 2 years ago, I was in a room not unlike this one with a group of economists, and these were, I don't know if you can really say progressive economists, but they were about as progressive as a group of economists can be. And we were there to talk about prevention and the economics of prevention. And I'm not an economist, but I do know a few things about prevention. I thought this is great. These economists are going to, you know, help me explain how you know, prevention makes economic sense and talk to policymakers. And what actually came out of it was that they told me prevention's great. You know, in my personal life, I run, I eat well, but it doesn't make economic sense. You can't make an economic case for prevention. They said, you know, it's too bad because nobody asks you if a quadruple bypass surgery is going to save money, but people do ask that about prevention, and when they do, you really can't say anything but no, it doesn't save money. And, you know, I've been pretty familiar with a lot of the public health successes that are very much prevention successes, and you look at tobacco control, removal of lead from the environment, helmet laws, all of these things have been proven to save money. So I was sort of swimming. I mean, I came out of this thinking, gosh, where do I go with this? This is really kind of deflating. And, you know, as a public health person, I'm not all that comfortable talking about money. And so my first thought was, well, let's just ignore it. You know, we'll sort of keep talking about doing good work in communities. But as we talked about it and I came back to my office, we realized that, you know, this is something we really need to be able to counter. We need to be able to make a rational argument for why prevention makes economic sense. So to flash forward a little bit for those of you who like to read the last chapter of the book first, this is a quote from Tommy Thompson from a few weeks ago. There's one unexpected long-term option that can help our stalling economy. Reforming our healthcare system through enhanced prevention and wellness. And he is one of about, this was in one of 200 articles that ran after a report we released a few weeks ago. And there's now a bill in Congress sponsored by Representative Roybal Allard encouraging the federal government to invest in prevention and to reduce regulatory barriers to that investment. So how'd we get there? Well, the first thing I realized when we were analyzing what I'd heard at this meeting was that these economists were thinking about prevention in a very narrow way. So we like to think about a two steps back approach to health. So if you take a health condition, say diabetes, here at the far right, you can think back to, okay, what are the behaviors and exposures that shape that disease? So poor eating, poor levels of physical activity, and then you can actually take a second step back and look at the environment and think about, okay, well, what are the factors in somebody's environment that influence eating and physical activity? So park access, access to healthy foods, and so forth. And what these economists were really talking about was prevention on the two far right elements. So you know, another way to think about it is I'm sure many of you are familiar with primary, secondary, tertiary prevention. They were thinking about screening, other clinical preventive services. And what we really wanted to get at was community level. What's happening in communities and how do you economically account for that? So these factors in the environment. So we started out, we released a report last summer. And just a couple of findings from that report. The first was we looked at what were the conditions that were driving the increases in healthcare costs. And we found that the majority of the conditions that were driving those costs were actually preventable. Secondly, we looked at the literature about what influences health. So it's a chance for glory, a quick pop quiz. The bar graph on the left side, there are three elements there. One of them is behavior and environment. One of them is genetics, and one of them is access to healthcare. So any guesses which one is 70%? Yes, behavior and environment. And on the right-hand side, you've got the breakdown of U.S. health expenditures. One of those is medical services, and one of them is prevention. And in that 4%, I won't trouble you for the answer on that one, that 4%, the majority of it is clinical preventive services. There's a very, very small fraction of that 4% that's going for community-level prevention. So we moved on from this to work with a group of economists from the Urban Institute, along with Trust for America's Health, New York Academy of Medicine, a few other partners, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, California Endowment, to really try and develop an economic model for prevention. And so we came up with this. This is the simplified version of that model, that you invest in prevention. You find some pool of money. You invest it in community-level prevention activities. Out of that, you can see improved nutrition and physical activity, reduced tobacco use. From this, there are reduced rates of disease, and in turn, there are public and private health care savings. So when we ran the numbers nationally, what we found was that looking at programs that had a good track record of effectiveness, you had to invest about $10 per capita in a community to have an effect, to have a 5% impact. So when we ran those numbers, we found that the return on investment after 5 years was basically 5.6 to 1. So we were looking at a $16 billion savings nationally. When you look at the short term, which is 1 to 2 years, you're looking at a 1 to 1 return on investment. So even within 2 years, spending $10 per capita, you do more than break even. You actually double your money in return. And a few other things that we noticed as we looked at this. One is that, so you notice I said healthcare costs. So there are actually a whole range of other costs that are associated with health. They're really, really hard to model, and that's the next step in this. You already see savings from healthcare costs, but if we start to think about things like productivity, ability to be effective parents, to volunteer, be civically engaged, all of those other factors, you see even a more robust return on investment from good health. The other thing that we notice is that when typical economic modeling is looking at a very linear relationship, you screen for disease A and you see whether or not you get outcome B. But if you do something like build a park, you're not building a park to affect diabetes. You're building a park to affect health broadly. So you're going to be affecting diabetes. You'll be affecting cardiovascular health. You have all sorts of other health impacts that can be accounted for. Another is that this investment is looking at the population on a very broad scale. So we're, absolutely every single person in the population. But there are ways to actually target those investments where you would maximize the return. So in certain communities, there are higher levels of disease. And so it follows that this is a map of California that was done by the California Pan-Ethnic Health Network of communities with the greatest health burden. So if you think about targeting those investments into communities that have that high burden, you would see a much greater return on investment. So what do we do about this? What do we do with this information? We've recently been talking with a number of policymakers in Sacramento to develop a set of policies and programs that a state, although we think we could certainly ramp these up nationally, could implement to operationalize this investment in prevention. So here are a few of the things that we've come up with. The first is indexing prevention to healthcare costs. We have that 4% investment. Researchers at the CDC have looked at what would happen if we upped that to 5% and increased the percentage that was going to community-level prevention. And they discovered that within 5 years, again, you would break even. It would start paying for itself. And after that, you would have additional funds to actually invest in community-level prevention. The other nice part about this is that as healthcare costs rise, you're automatically investing in this sort of community-level prevention that will reduce disease rates. The second, and probably the most difficult and charged idea, is that when we looked at the data for where the savings go, a lot of it is going to private insurance companies. As people get healthier, private insurance companies are going to reap the benefit. So how do we get them to invest? And this is certainly an argument, I think, for single payer. If you have a pool of people who all have a sort of shared economic destiny, the idea of investing up front to keep them healthier and cheaper makes a lot of sense. And in California, we're seeing this with Kaiser Permanente that actually has a large enough section of the population that they understand investing in farmers markets, health clubs, walkable communities, and so forth. But in a system where you have fractured healthcare providers and insurers, there's really no incentive. People are moving from insurer to insurer rapidly. For the most part, the public sector, when people reach a certain age, is going to pick up the tab for a lot of those chronic disease costs. So how do we actually incentivize the private sector to invest in communities? So one idea is essentially to sort of put out a package of prevention investments and fine insurers who will not pay into this system. A second is that you have a wellness trust. And this is an idea that's getting a little bit of traction nationally. Hillary Clinton just put forth some legislation about a wellness trust. It would be kind of a clearinghouse for money that comes in from private insurers and then goes out to communities to fund community-level prevention activities. The next is to create a cabinet-level committee that's accountable for health impacts. And I think that probably the simplest way to think about this is that there are all sorts of government expenditures that affect health, but they're not thought of that way. We're about to pass a massive transportation reauthorization, and that's going to have broad, broad health impacts. But health people aren't at the table delineating what those health impacts are and saying, investment in biking and walking and public transportation has these health impacts as opposed to building freeways. And so the idea is that you have a cross-sectoral committee that's responsible for identifying and supporting those health impacts. Next is the idea of a statewide accountability plan. People say that what gets counted counts. And so if you change what's getting counted, you will inevitably change what gets funded. So if we're counting death rates, then we're probably going to fund hospital procedures. But if we're counting walkability, school lunch programs, and the quality of the food, then that's probably where we're going to put our emphasis. And so the idea is that there are a number of organizations that are working on developing report cards for states that change the dialogue about what we're counting. This is one example from a report that we issued last year for the California Endowment about community report cards and how they can be structured. And lastly, the strategies that I'm talking about could potentially be implemented locally. So we need to develop pilot projects at a local level, work with local health departments to actually implement some of these ideas on a local level, develop kind of the knowledge base and the case studies that can then be amplified and taken to the state and national level. There's been a lot of talk recently about the economic crisis, and I think we have a real opportunity in public health to see how the economic factors, health factors, and environmental factors really intersect, and that an investment in healthy communities and a healthy workforce in the long run makes an enormous amount of economic sense. Moment of self-promotion, we're developing a platform around these issues to look at, to encourage investment in community health and workforce health as part of a stimulus package. And anybody who's interested in this, we're certainly going to want support and input from a wide range of institutions and individuals. So please get in touch with me. I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Joel. Or Jeremy, rather. Our last speaker is Martha Livingston, whose topic is Beyond Single Payer, A Vision of Healthcare Justice. Martha is an associate professor of health and society at the State University of New York at Old Westbury, where she teaches and researches U.S. healthcare, comparative healthcare systems, international health, health policy, medical ethics, and women's health. She was the recipient of the 2003 SUNY Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Teaching. She's vice chair of the board of directors of the New York Metro chapter of Physicians for National Health Program. She's a member of the editorial board of the Journal of Public Health Policy. She's spoken widely on the topic of healthcare reform. Dr. Livingston lived and studied for several years in the province of Saskatchewan in Canada. She's researched and written on healthcare in Canada, and she was a recipient in 1994 of the Canadian Embassy's Canadian Studies Research Grant. She's the co-editor of 10 Excellent Reasons, which is the little book that's right there, and she nearly single-handedly helps keep the Socialist Caucus alive.
Thanks, but there's something profoundly wrong with the concept of nearly single-handedly keeping a Socialist Caucus alive. So, like-minded folks who are interested in helping us do that work, please see me and others here after our session is over. Thanks so much. I just wanted to make a quick comment on the concept of prevention. I find it interesting that Jeremy sent his presentation to the Socialist Caucus. I mean, isn't that an interesting thing? There are so many other places where that presentation could have happened. And I noted that in the very long list of ways in which Jeremy and his group are talking about improving the public's health, if you looked really closely at that slide, you would find the line, living wage jobs in the neighborhood. Michael Marmot told us on Sunday that only about 25% of people's health could be explained with reference to individual behavior, and rejected the notion that the social determinants approach takes away individual responsibility, saying that it gives people the means to do so psychosocially, materially, politically. So as a Socialist Caucus member, I felt the need to re-inject the social determinants of health at every moment in the notion of what we're really talking about by prevention. I especially loved that first slide with the two steps back, because that's really what you have to do to understand what we're talking about prevention. So this session was organized by the Socialist Caucus. Why? I mean, single-payer healthcare reform. I've spent the last, a good portion of the last about 16, 17 years of my life working for single-payer healthcare reform, which I, as a socialist, consider the most right-wing movement I've ever been associated with. You laugh, but the fact is that single-payer is really a modest, some would say even tepid, reform. It really is not, as I hear from some of my more timid colleagues in the movement for healthcare reform, it is not the end goal, it's not the be-all and end-all, it is but the first step, without which we can't even begin to address the myriad inequalities and inequities in health, as well as in how healthcare is organized and delivered. I've been saying, or I did say back in the Clinton reform moment, that we in PNHP and others who felt the way we do about single payer should have been chaining ourselves to the White House gates demanding socialized medicine, at which point the center, the Clintons and such, would have scurried to single payer as the modest compromise solution, but unfortunately nobody listened, and I didn't want to do it all by myself, just like I don't want to run the Socialist Caucus by myself. So what are we really talking about here? The single-payer movement is, after all, a single-issue movement. I see it, as I said, as really the platform that we need to be able to get to in order to look at how to address all of the other issues that we are powerfully concerned about. First of all, about health care. We want the ability to see whatever provider we want. In Dr. Fine's presentation, you heard whatever doctor, whatever hospital. When I think about providers, coming as I do out of, among other things, the women's health movement and the childbirth reform movement, I want us not only to be able to see the doctor of our choice, but the midwife of our choice, the nurse practitioner of our choice, the chiropractor of our choice, the nutritionist of our choice, the acupuncturist of our choice, the health counselor of our choice. That, to me, is something that is incredibly, incredibly important. Women need to be able to see practitioners who are respectful and knowledgeable about our health concerns, who don't blow us off as nervous, whiny complainers, especially when we have chronic, intractable, and life-threatening conditions. Again, coming out of the birth movement, the way that birth is handled in the United States is an absolute disgrace, and also, P.S., and by the way, wastes an extraordinary amount of money, delivering just the most ghastly care in so, so many instances. And this is not to say OBGYNs are terrible human beings. A few of them are, but many of them really love women and care about us in birth. They just haven't been trained in how birth is a normal physiological event. They really don't, profoundly don't get that. I'm reminded as I speak about women's health issues of an ad that I saw about 20 years ago in the journal OB when I was doing my dissertation about childbirth. And this was an ad that showed the top half showed a woman, and then the bottom half she had morphed into a chair. And the caption was, "Don't let her become a fixture in your office." In other words, the woman as whiny complainer who really doesn't have anything wrong with her, and can anybody guess what it was an ad for? It was 20 years ago. You're close. You're close. Valium. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember once when I had a really painful shoulder bursitis being patted on the same shoulder by an orthopod who said that I really needed to take Valium, that I shouldn't be so nervous. That's actually when I found the first chiropractor I ever went to who treated me, and it got better pretty quick. Americans of color need to see practitioners who are active partners in helping us stay or get healthy, whatever that takes. We can't get rid of health care disparities until we can fire disrespectful or uncaring providers. Michael Marmot reminded us yet again on Sunday that if racism didn't exist, we would have had 886,202 fewer deaths in this country from 1991 to 2000. I want to know how. I mean, that must be some powerful statistical method that can come up with a number that ends in a 2. I mean, that's just a remarkable, remarkable statement. But it's a remarkable statement, isn't it? We're talking about a disparity in life expectancy of 6 full years of life, and we're talking about lives of disability and ill health that can just barely be measured. Those disparities need to end. Health care isn't the whole story. We know that. Single payer is a platform from which Americans of color will be able to demand caring and decent and respectful health care. So that's, again, this is what single payer does for us. Those of us who want to be able to use non-standard treatments don't want to be hassled. Some of those treatments, and I read a list of sort of non-standard providers earlier, some of those treatments are not even amenable to randomized controlled clinical trials. I think about homeopathy. My kid laughs at me all the time about spending $6 for a small vial of water. because, of course, there are no discernible molecules of anything but water in homeopathic treatments. It's hard to do RCTs on some of these methods. What I like to point out respectfully to my physician colleagues, however, is that the vast proportion of standard medical care has not been subjected to RCTs either. I think, for example, of one treatment that existed as routine in care of women during childbirth, that was a treatment that was started in this country early in the 20th century when poor and immigrant women went into hospital for the first time in large numbers to have babies, and their pubic hair was shaved in the course of birth. It was shaved because these poor and immigrant women often had lice, and that was a treatment for lice. Now, why in 1970, 1980, even into the 1990s, were women routinely having their pubic hair shaved during birth? I don't think because your great-grandmother had lice is really an adequate medical explanation. And yet, that's how medical practice continues. The argument was, of course, to create a sterile field. Those docs weren't thinking about pubic lice. And that's a whole other argument we're not going to have right now. 100,000 Americans, it's estimated, die each year from medication errors. If we had a less pharmaceutical-driven medical practice, many of those deaths could be prevented. So single-payer doesn't address any of this stuff. It simply moves the money from the clutches of the profiteers into the public sector. But this is a very important step. It opens, as they say, the window on the social wage. That's why corporations that have been hurting, really just getting killed by out-of-control healthcare costs for their employees, haven't leapt aboard the single-payer movement. They get it. Workers who are entitled to health care as a human right can also imagine a living wage, child care, decent education, affordable decent housing in unpolluted communities. That really is both naive and subversive, isn't it? We go way beyond health care then to talk about the determinants of a life of dignity and purpose and a just world. We had a similar panel here at APHA last year where we raised a similar sets of issues. The world has changed profoundly since last year. We're on the verge of electing a new president and Congress that will have the potential to be less hostile to the needs of working people. We have an economic disaster on our hands that has really opened working class Americans' eyes for the first time in decades to the reality of class. People get this. Even my students get this. I've got students whose families are being foreclosed on, who have gotten no help, who are desperate, kids working three jobs and trying to maintain and go to college. They really get this deeply. I used to have to really, hit them over the head with a sledgehammer about social class. They don't want to think about social class. This is America. Anybody can be president. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. They are really starting to get this. The way the masters of the universe have arranged the world economically, politically, and socially since the Second World War is crumbling as we speak. The Chinese have a character that is the same character for danger and opportunity. That's the moment we find ourselves in here. Our less visionary friends keep telling us that single payer is not politically possible, but it's the only solution to the healthcare financing mess that is economically possible, as you saw in Dr. Fine's presentation. As David Himmelstein and Steffi Woolhandler tell us, advocating for anything less, doing the same old, over and over again, is using placebos when there's an effective treatment out there, and that's not only useless, it's unethical. How do we change the world? We need two things we don't have enough of now. One is power. We know that. If we had the power, we'd have had single payer and a more just world long since. But we have some power we don't recognize. In 1 week, we're going to exercise one form of that power. The other thing we don't have is imagination. We need to be able to imagine healthcare justice if we're ever, ever going to get there. Arundhati Roy says, "We be many and they be few. They need us more than we need them. Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." Or as the old man with the beard used to say, "We have nothing to lose but our chains. We have a world to win. Let's do it."
I just wanted to make one announcement. This evening, the medical care section is holding an evening with Steffi Wohlhandler and David Himmelstein. You're all invited to come to that at 6:30 to 8. It will be in the Marina Marriott in the North Tower in the Marriott Hall. So it's down one flight, I think, from the lobby. But really, consider coming and hearing from truly the founders and some of the really intellectual leaders in the single-payer healthcare movement.
Thank you to all of our speakers. Thank you, Martha, for your always powerful presentations. Are there questions that we can take for the speakers? Yeah. Can you go to the microphone, please? Thanks.
This question is for Jeremy Cantor. I have tried to raise this issue of savings and prevention in many instances. In fact, my organization has shown that investing in asthma education and home-based environmental interventions can really reap a return on investment. But nevertheless, the naysayers always come back and say, prevention may do us good, but it ultimately is not going to save us money because ultimately we're going to live longer and the healthcare system is going to still have to support people over the long term. I'm wondering how you would respond to that.
Yeah, no, I think I can. Can you hear me?
Okay, I'll use the mic.
Yeah, that's a great comment and one that I've heard quite frequently over the last year as well. In fact, I think at the at that first meeting I went to, somebody pulled me aside and we were talking, and he described what I hadn't heard before of the Chinese tobacco paradox, when a representative from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services was in China. This may be an apocryphal story, but in the 80s, when rates of tobacco use were skyrocketing, and said to his counterpart in China, "Well, what are you going to do about this? You've got to get these costs under control." And he said, "Do something about it. No, this is great. If people die a quick death at 50." That's actually fine. That's good economically for us. And, part of that is it sort of underlines a crazy approach. I mean, what's our objective in providing health care or health services? It's to preserve health and extend life. And that's certainly the rationale that's used in thinking about any medical treatment or surgical procedure. So we should apply the same rationale. But the other side of that is that there is a growing body of literature that emphasizes that what really drives costs as people get older is it's syndemics. It's multiple conditions. It's when somebody, breaks their hip, then their mobility is reduced, then they get diabetes, then the diabetes increases their risk for a whole bunch of other conditions, and they end up with four or five chronic conditions for extended periods of time. That's when costs really go through the roof. So there's some work out of Stanford on what they're calling the compression of morbidity, and that if you can narrow that length of time at the end of life when somebody is in need of extensive medical treatment, you can reduce costs. And so if you get to age 65 in better health, you're actually cheaper even if you live longer. So it's sort of, that question has been coming up, I think, for anybody who's been in this field and for 10, 20 years, and there is a growing body of literature around that. So, and I can certainly get you some of those studies.
I just wanted to add, from a single-payer point of view, prevention is likely to cost something at the outset, right? We're going to have to make more investments wherever they are. And the problem is that the benefit is likely to be something that is yielded in 10, 20, 30 years. You then begin to understand why private health insurance companies are not that interested in prevention, because in fact they're not going to yield the benefit. The benefit they see will be in fact yielded perhaps in the Medicare program, the costs that go down, but that's not their interest. That's why, again, we need to go to a single payer program, a program that in fact does not include private health insurance.
Go ahead.
I'm going to take the prerogative of being the senior member here who's probably thought on these issues longer than anyone else to make a pitch for looking at the new opportunity of Obama coming in and looking at the broader social determinants of health in relation to the community health center movement and look at the possibility politically now to do what we tried to do in 1965 when we started the community health center. Deal with all of the social issues in the community. We have an opportunity to talk about community health centers are powerful now. They've got a big lobby, but they're narrow. They're nowhere near what they were when we had the Office of Economic Opportunity. We're going to have need for jobs. We're going to have need for lots of work in the infrastructure. It's time to come back to that concept and push Obama for a new approach. While we're fighting for single payer, let us get to work in the community, to get community organizers. We're going to have a president who is a community organizer. He gets that picture. It's a political opportunity that I urge us not to let go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just want to recognize that that commenter is Dr. Joyce Lashoff, a former president of APHA. And I also, Joyce, you just made me think of Jack Geiger's story about Mississippi and the prescriptions that he wrote. How many people know that story? Okay, for those of you who don't, Dr. Jack Geiger, another one of our heroes in the healthcare justice movement, in the community health center movement, in Mississippi in the mid-1960s when establishing that government-funded community health center, wrote prescriptions for his patients for food that they would then take to the grocery store to buy food. And the feds questioned him about this and said, you know, wait a second, this isn't medicine. He said, look, I've diagnosed a condition called malnutrition. The treatment for malnutrition is food. So this is a perfectly legitimate use of that prescriptive power. And it worked.
Go ahead.
I have a specific question about single payer, a particular type of service, and a concern that I have about single payer plan. Dr. Feiner, I was glad to see you include reproductive health as one of the many types of services that you would envision, you and others envision. But I have to say, as a reproductive rights advocate, I have concerns knowing the vagaries of Congress and who's in power, and specifically the many and varied efforts to restrict abortion services in certain populations. To look at the Hyde Amendment of 30 plus years ago, to restrict public funding of abortions for poor women, or regardless of economic status. I look at that as a backdrop for some of the concerns that I have about who would decide what services are provided, and specifically, it may seem like picayune to think, well, abortion services are such a particular case, but
this is a central component of women's reproductive health. And I'm curious to know, curious to hear a comment from either Dr. Fine or the last speaker, and I apologize, I don't recall your name, if you have any comments about that. Thank you.
Yes, I think those are real concerns, and the issue, again, of how the benefit package is going to be determined, the coverage package, is a real concern. It's one of the reasons that I've argued that it ought to be perhaps one step away from direct congressional control, and that's why, in fact, a coverage board, a board that included a variety of constituencies, I think may be the way for us to go. We haven't articulated this sharply. That's something that would really need to be worked out in the political process. But it doesn't seem to me to be adequate to arguing that we shouldn't go and have a single-payer system. I think that we can, in fact, distance the coverage decisions from the direct political process, essentially. And I think that will make a big difference. Frankly, right now, what our real problem is that many of these decisions are being made by private insurance companies to whom we have absolutely no recourse to make any changes. They, in fact, deny claims, retrospectively deny coverage. Those are things that really need to change. So I understand your concern. I think it's very important that we address it.
As I've been speaking about single payer, low these number of years, I often speak to groups of midwives, of women's health providers, of practitioners of alternative and complementary medicine who say to me, but, you know, our stuff has got to be included in the plan. And I say, look, I'm not an insurance salesman. We need to be at that table. That's why I'm speaking to you. We need all of us to be at that table, because I am always reminded of one of my sheroes who's in the audience, Billy Avery, saying the following thing. You know, Billy, what it is. If you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu.
Go ahead.
Hi. I guess I went into a great depression after the Clinton moment, because I'd worked so long and so hard for that moment and thought something would happen. Mm-hmm. And in these last 16, in these innumerable years, I've watched everything get worse. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that given the economic situation we face, we really do face the problem of wringing dollars out of all of the terrible things that have been done during this 1.5 decades. I'm just wondering where the members of the panel think we can stop doing things. I mean, our basic idea is primum non nocere, and we've been wounding the world and wounding our people for so long. So what are the things that we should stop doing in order to get some money to do some of the things like prevention that we should do?
Mm-hmm. Who'd like to start?
The argument's been made for many years, and I think no time better than now to say, for example, that we have pissed away lives and billions in a disgusting, unnecessary war. But we don't have to make that argument. Single-payer advocates understand that we can't in the United States, especially now, especially in the time of an economic crisis, we can't afford not to do single-payer, because it is the only solution that captures the money that we're already spending in the system and actually provides health care with it. So that's really the way that I look at it. In this moment of, we're in a financial crisis, we're going to be told by the other side that we can't afford to do anything about anything because we're so busy bailing out bankers. Well, the fact of the matter is, we can't afford not to do this.
Just quickly to add to that, I think Dr. Fine illustrated there's some administrative costs, there's some places where we're spending money where we probably shouldn't be, but I think the other side is that we just need to spend the money we're spending smarter. I've really come to believe in looking at the evidence that if we do pay attention, as Dr. Lashoff mentioned, to social determinants of health, building healthy communities in which people have high quality housing, a living wage, a clean environment, places to play, to walk, healthy food, that ultimately pays for itself. And that, you know, as we, if we can figure out how to reinvest that money that's saved, and you know, when healthcare insurance companies save the money, if we can figure out a way to, you know, to bring that back into the communities and continue to fund that redevelopment, that ultimately, we've sort of got a feedback loop that will feed itself. So it's really, I think, a matter of looking at our current expenditures with a different lens, particularly a health lens.
Hi, I'm Corinne. I'm a family medicine and preventive medicine resident from Portland, Oregon. And I really appreciate your talk. Everything you guys have said has been fantastic. I wanted to ask, and it relates to the past two questions, actually, about cost control, that I think that in going to a single-payer system, which is obviously the thing that makes sense for this country and for all countries, how can we look forward into how we're going to control the cost? When you look at the way that our country does spend its medical dollars, it is very technology and intensive, ICU intensive, end-of-life specialist intensive. And similar to the community health center system and now the medical home idea, is there any effort in terms of what is nationally being talked about as a proposal to get a better regulation or oversight on what technology has evidence behind it and can be used rationally as opposed to the sort of emotional new era is better and therefore I deserve it approach that I think that a lot of consumers as well as practitioners take, and it's hard to overcome?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, Ollie.
Well, I alluded to the fact that I'm not at all sure that we are such over-utilizers of care, particularly not in the primary care arena. So, you know, we have, for instance, the lowest number of visits to a physician per capita among the industrialized nations. We have the fewest number of days in the hospital per capita. In terms of some of the truly specialized things like transplants, we are doing in the mid-range of transplants when you look at the industrialized world, not the top number. Yes, there is probably an overuse of some technology in our system. That, I think, does relate to the fact that we are increasingly depending on specialists rather than on primary care physicians and teams. I certainly respond to Martha's idea that there could be much more use of, you know, nurse practitioners and physician assistants in our system. The question is, how does one get there? And one of the ways, frankly, it seems to me, and perhaps the only way, is through a single-payer system. How can we address those problems through a single-payer system, I think, is the way to begin to get to the ability to make the policies that begin to favor primary care and move us away from an emphasis on specialty medicine.
Set it to put some things on the so eloquently pointed out, and I didn't know the history of that as well as you clearly do. But so my question then would be, how would single payer get at this kind of misuse of capital, you know, overpricing, the administrative waste is probably connected to that too, in the sense that a lot of the capital has built insurance companies.
Yeah, let me say that there is some explicit proposal around this in H.R. 676, which is the Conyers, you know, single-payer bill. And that language talks in terms of hospitals being globally budgeted so that they would, in fact, be able to get a global single budget per year and that they would have to separate their capital from their operating expenses. And then the capital expenses, and again, this may be unfortunately going back too much to certificate of need, you know, to CON processes, but they would, the capital expenses would need, in fact, a different way of being budgeted, a different way of actually looking at what are the resources in a community, and to what degree are they being underutilized, and so forth. We would also, frankly, as part of that bill, really try to reduce the number of for-profit entities that were delivering, you know, high-tech services, and move much more to a system in which all the delivery system is embodied in a non-profit approach. But you may have other ways of looking at it.
Well, just briefly, just looking at it structurally rather than in terms of payment, I think we've been training too many specialists, and I think we need to start reducing the amount, the number of specialists we're training. Also, look at the Medicare funding that is encouraging hospitals across the board now to buy, you know, expensive equipment like proton accelerators. I think we need limits on what hospitals can do, and on how many, what kinds of doctors we should have.
Take one more.
Medicare currently has an unfunded liability of, I think it's $15.7 trillion for current participants. How did we get to that point in Medicare, and how do we avoid getting even to a worse position under a single-payer system?
Not quite sure what you mean by an unfunded liability. The Medicare program, as you know, has in its basic organization funding that probably would only run out by 2019 at this juncture. That's what the CBO projects. And when people say to me, oh, they're very scared about that, I say, well, you know, you go back and look at the length of time that the Medicare program was going to go broke. In 1970, it was 2 years. In 1974, it was 4 years. In 1980, it was somewhere around 8 years. And then it went back down to 5 years. We have had Medicare is going to go broke in much shorter periods of time than we presently have. Then, in addition to that, you have to ask the question, to what degree has the tax rate for Medicare gone up? The last tax increase, payroll tax increase, which was up to 1.45% out of your, you know, payroll, was made in 1986. And then, yes, okay, in 1993, the Social Security cap on the program was removed, and that, you could argue, was a tax increase on the wealthy, it should be said. But otherwise, there's been no increased taxes going in to the Medicare program. So I'm not as distressed about this. I think that, in fact, if we move to single payer, what we could see happen is, frankly, most people would be paying less than they're presently paying for their private premiums, and most corporations would probably be contributing less, in fact, if they would just transfer, frankly, what they're putting into premiums, you know, into the single-payer fund. but actually it would end up costing them less. So I'm much less distressed about the issue of going financially broke.
Okay, we'll stop there. Thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it.
Please consider buying this wonderful book.
Direct parallel.